level me.
Good cough. Great cough. Good start. Top tier cough.
I'm trying my German.
Are you ready?
Yeah.
Live from the Mundangerous Low-Hanging Orchard in New York City, I'm your host Shane.
And I'm your host Ishan.
And welcome to episode 100 of Total Party Thrill, a podcast for game masters and players where we discuss our campaigns in order to inspire yours.
In this episode, we're taking a break from our usual format to make some announcements and also answer your mailbag questions. Hey, it's episode 100, so cut us some slack.
Later, we'll record our first and likely only musical iTunes review. You may want to keep the fast-forward button handy for that part.
I know I will. And finally, Baron Munchausen performs dubious feats of Daring Do in the Character Creation Forge.
So before we get into all the fun and festivities, just a reminder, the first three parts of the annotated history of Brand Talandro is up on Tribality. Thank you to Sean Ellsworth from Tribality for letting us do that, and to Quinn Wilson for providing some awesome artwork.
We'll have a bit more information on that later in the episode. Also, fair warning, if this is the first episode of Total Party Thrill that you've ever listened to, try starting with episode 99 first. That's really more representative of our usual format and, quite honestly, quality, such as it is.
Yeah, given that we have to perform a musical review at the end of this episode, we have already started drinking, so this is going to be a little light and loose.
This is actually, I think this is only the second episode where we have been drinking while recording. Episode one, we drank. And that took forever.
Yeah, that one we had to record like six times, every passage.
And it needed so much editing. And this time, we are also drinking.
Yeah, but this time we're going to lightly edit it, so you can enjoy how terrible we are.
We've
also only lightly prepared. There was a couple questions where we had to do a little bit of background research before we could give a good answer, but we've mostly not prepared answers, so it's going to be pretty off the cuff.
Yeah, we're trying to shoot from the hip. Because I think that's really what people expect from us.
And also, it's episode 100. We're taking one off.
Also, it's going to be a long one, so strap in.
Yeah, we're just bail now. So, speaking of episode 100, this is first and foremost a thank you to everybody who has been involved and everybody who listens and everybody who supports us. You guys are amazing. And I especially want to give a shout out to Michael from the RPG Academy, who was my first friend in the podcasting community and gave me my first chance to speak into a microphone for other people to hear on the internet. And then he also had the decency to edit out all of my nervous ums.
Yeah, it's something that we haven't been doing.
Right.
Also, I believe he was the first one to believe in you as a podcaster, probably long before I believed in you as a podcaster.
That's almost certainly true. He was on our short list of people who previewed the first episode and was like, I think he got something here, but maybe fix some stuff.
Right, like the hosts.
Yeah. Also, we've recorded like literally 99 out of 100 episodes on his equipment or his old equipment that he was kind enough to sell to us. So
very at a very reasonable price.
At a very affordable rate for getting started.
So he said.
Yeah. And he has been kicking himself ever since. So
I'm sure we're going to get a message. Please do not associate me with this.
Yeah, yeah. But we don't have time to give individual thank yous to everybody who's been involved. But for Michael, seriously, thank you very much. We would not be here without you.
We also want to thank all of you who have listened to us throughout 100 episodes. We know it's been a chore and a slog, but thanks for sticking it out with us.
Yeah, we've had a couple good ideas surrounded by a lot of filler. So thank you for suffering through that.
Yeah, anyone who downloads the show, shares it with a friend, writes us a review on iTunes, emails us, tweets us, retweets us, shares our posts on Facebook, or wears our t-shirts, probably inside out.
Yeah, whether we chat with you every week or you write us one email in an emergency.
Whether you have been listening since 2015 or you've just finished binging the entire back catalog, I don't know if you know, but there are, in fact, 99 episodes.
Plus an episode zero.
Oh, yeah. So this is actually episode 100.25.
Sort of. Well, we recorded episode zero twice, so.
or if you've just found us and this is, as we warned you not to do, the first episode that you've ever listened to, thank you very much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much for making us a part of your gaming experience.
So we've been promising you an announcement, and well, here it is. After 2 solid years of funding all of this on our own and just sort of throwing money into the void, we are announcing that we are finally unveiling a Patreon account.
Yeah, we've been asked about this for a long time. Why don't you have one? How can I support the show? All of these different things. You guys are amazingly supportive of us. So we have decided to go ahead and launch a Patreon as a way of kind of funding new content for Total Party Thrill.
Right. So even if you aren't going to donate through Patreon, you're going to get more stuff because we're going to be able to produce more stuff, much of which we will actually be releasing to everyone.
Yeah. So first of all, if you don't know what Patreon is, it's a website that allows you to kind of set up a recurring pledge month after month. It just builds your credit card and then sends that money to the artists and creators that you support.
Yeah, it's kind of like having a kid in college, but much cheaper.
Yeah, yeah. And then on top of that, there are sort of reward tiers based on your pledge levels, things that we give back to you based on how much money you give each month, and then also goals that are tied to the total amount of pledges that we have as a creator.
Yeah, over the last 2 years, we have received so many good ideas for really cool things that we could do with the podcast. But at this point, we're pretty much maxed out on the capacity that we have to invest in this while still continuing to remain married to women who are reasonable.
And gainfully employed. But one or the other has to give.
Yeah, we've talked about this before, but each episode takes like 12 to 15 man hours to prep, write, record, edit, and then post.
Yeah, and we, right now, we alternate those editing and writing duties, so a couple listeners have noticed that in some episodes, Ishan is the jerk, in other episodes, Shane is the jerk, and it's totally dependent on who wrote the episode and then who edited the episode. So we share those, and we generally alternate, you know, as life and schedules get in the way, sometimes we have to kind of double back, but we've made that split work. It's just that it doesn't leave a whole lot of time for family and work and all the other things going on to also do the cool things that you guys have asked us about. And we want to finally fulfill those wishes.
Yeah. The point of this is to enable us to hire some people in the community and, you know, actually pay them a fair wage to help out with side projects or additional content that we've got. I think all of you saw the brand Talandro portrait.
Mm-hmm.
Shane had that commissioned by Quinn Wilson, who got paid some amount of money.
A reasonable amount of money.
We would like to do more of those kinds of things. It also keeps us from having to run ads, which neither of us really wants to do.
Yeah.
And since we don't like asking for something without offering something in return, if you head over to our Patreon site right now, which is patreon.com/totalpartythrill, you'll be able to read part 4 of the annotated history of Brand Talandro.
Yeah, so part 4 really kicks off when 5th edition came out.
By the official final rules, the PHB.
Right, right. So as you might recall in the Morning Glory campaign, we had started with the D&D Next playtest. And if you read the first 3 installments of that history on Tribality, you might have noticed that the rules were a little bit off from 5th edition. That's because they were the playtest rules. And we tried to annotate where that was different. But then, as we were playing, the PHB got released, and we all said, hey, let's go remake our characters however we want to and re-implement them in the game.
At the same time, Brand kind of had a bit of a crisis of faith spurred by events within the game.
Yeah, yeah.
So this part 4 is a lot of us going back and forth via email, or actually I think G-chats start making an appearance here.
Yeah.
Also some not safe for work language.
Definitely.
Which is definitely not edited out. Talking about what the next iteration of Brand is going to look like. A word of warning, it is very long. It is about as long as the first 3 parts that showed up on Tribality put together. And there's going to be a 5th part coming as well. When we started compiling this entire project, we realized it was about 25,000 words long. And we both kind of went, well, that's too much.
That was before we started annotating.
Right. But then we thought about one of our favorite written series, the All Guardsmen Party. So we want to give a shout out to Shaggy, who compiles all of that. Those are like essentially green text, but they run 30,000 words per episode.
Right. And we sat and read so many of them as we played Dark Heresy.
Right. There was never a moment I was reading those when I was like, man, I wish this was over.
Right.
Right. Even after sitting there for 2 hours on my phone, my battery's dead. And I'm just like, that's it?
Yeah.
Really? So we hope that, you know, once we put this entire package together, you'll, you know, read it all at once and find it enjoyable.
So that is available right now on Patreon for you to check out.
Even if you are not currently or not going to be a Patreon sponsor, that is available for you right now.
Right. All you have to do is click the link in the show notes and you will find it.
For those of you, though, who do decide that you want to throw a bit of money our way, there are some additional things you'll get.
Yeah, so let's talk about the goals. This is the total amount that we are pledged each month. So when we get to $100 a month, we will release a supercut of the Morning Glory campaign as an MP3 to all of our patrons.
So we're going to go through all of the, well, the first 73 episodes.
Yep.
Pull out all of the Morning Glory recaps.
Yep.
String them all together in a long MP3.
Yep.
Edit them more appropriately.
So there's not too much duplication.
Maybe add a bit of additional content where things need to be clarified.
Oh, dear.
Oh, boy. And then give that. I thought this was supposed to be make less work for us.
Yeah. Actually, this is sounding like a lot of work. But yeah, so that'll be available to patrons at the $100 level. I think that is probably a relatively reasonable goal that we might hit that relatively quickly. After that, it's just going to be as it comes. And that's why the sort of the higher goals that we have are mostly going to be asking somebody to do this work for us and paying them. Yeah. Because I think after I've already started working on the Morning Glory recut, but anything after that, I'm just like, I'm exhausted. So at $200, we will be documenting all of our Character Creation Forge builds and releasing them as a codex, available on TotalPartyThrillCast.com for anyone to search and index and check out. And just, you know, if you're looking for a quick build for a game or a one-shot or whatever, you'll have all of that content available to you.
Yeah, this is one of the biggest requests that we get on a regular basis. It is, though, a lot of work to go back through all 100 episodes and pull out the build and the breakdown and then put together sort of like a leveling plan.
Right.
But we're going to do it.
Slowly but surely. It will not be released all at once. It'll probably be released in like 10 to 15 builds at a time, but we will eventually get it up to speed where we're updating it on a regular basis.
Like weekly? Like every time there's a new build?
Yeah, that's what I would call regular.
At $300, we're going to put out a Total Party Thrill guide to Unearthed Arcana. It's basically a quick guide to what we would or would not allow at our table from the Unearthed Arcana material that's been released by Wizards of the Coast.
Yeah, that'll just be like a simple thumbs up, thumbs down rating system on the broad strokes of
all things. Thumbs down.
Yeah, it's not true.
Every single one.
I like some of them. I like many of them, actually.
All thumbs up.
There's a lot of them that are underpowered, and that's why we complained, and those would be thumbs up.
Yeah, go for it, but with a caveat. At $500, I'm excited about this. We will do an actual play episode with Shane's mom.
Well, an actual play series, actually.
You know, this was your idea. I didn't come up with this.
So
you're the one offering your mom up for podcast consumption.
So we've talked about this a bit before, that my mother listens to our show and that she has been slowly making her way through the back catalog, not at a weekly pace, but every once in a while she sends me a text and she's like, what is this thing that you guys keep saying? What does that mean? And then also she's very excited that like she gets to share a hobby that she never really understood when I was playing role-playing games with my friends in high school. And, you know, then I moved out of the house, so she never really saw it again. So she's kind of enjoying a trip down memory lane, and she's interested in it. She's kind of a nerd, but she's never played RPGs. So we're going to fire up the old recording studio and see what happens.
So who's going to run? Me, and I'm going to run you and your mom and maybe some other people, or are you going to run your mom?
I think you'll probably have to run us too, and we'll just figure it out from there.
Oh, TPK.
Yeah, probably.
Immediately.
Depending on how big of a disaster that is, we might release it on the main feed, and if it's truly terrible, it'll be patron only, and you guys can just enjoy our misery.
And then, you know, upload it to torrent sites.
Right. It's a $500 goal, so it's like, I don't know that we're ever going to hit that.
For $1 million, I'll play a game with my mom. My mom doesn't know I have a podcast. I'm going to keep it that way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She's
better for everyone.
She's enjoying her ignorance.
Of course, even beyond that, we've set some stretch goals.
This is the dumbest goal we have ever come up with. So at $1,000, which is as high as I'm willing to forecast, even so, we will do an actual play of the classic drinking game Power Hour, in which we take one drink every minute for an hour.
Not a shot.
No, I mean, just a solid gulp.
But it's probably going to be liquor.
Right.
Yeah.
And during this time, we will also attempt to answer your mailbag questions, though I predict that will work for about 30 minutes.
Yeah, get them in early so you get it answered.
Yeah, yeah.
Or send something where the answer would be slurrable.
Yeah, yeah. And can't imagine that one getting posted publicly.
Oh, boy. So these are not set in stone. If you'd like us to add more goals, let us know what you'd like to see, because we're absolutely open to suggestions. Now, those are the goals that all patrons or all listeners get once in aggregate we reach a certain level. But for you specifically, if you become a patron, depending on how much you contribute each month, you'll also get something just for you.
Yeah, so at $2, that's our sort of basic patron tier. That gets you access to our patron-only feed within Patreon, where we plan to post a lot of our sort of game content that we've sort of accumulated and that we've been talking about, as well as any of the things that we unlock for patrons will be available to you. That's at $2 a month. At $5 a month, this is when we start getting into physical rewards.
Oh, stuff.
So at $5, we will send you a TPT button to wear at conventions or your local nerd store.
Yeah, it's not swag, because not everyone gets it.
Right.
I guess it's sjpug. It's stuff just patrons get.
Oh, okay, nice. Yeah, that's pronounceable.
Yep. At $10 a month, you join the t-shirt club. After 3 months at this level, we will send you a Total Party Thrill t-shirt as a thank you. If you've already got a t-shirt, we'll figure something out.
Yeah. At $20 a month, you can put words in our mouth. So after 3 months at this level, we will read your message on the air.
Yeah, he said words. Words in our mouth.
Yeah, yeah. Probably also liquor.
Yes. I mean, depending on what words.
Yeah. I mean, as long as it's not offensive or, you know, too long, I guess. Those are probably the two criteria. We'll pretty much say anything.
Yeah. And, you know, we bleep liberally, so.
Yeah.
Have at it.
But, yeah, if you have a project that you want us to give a shout out to, or, I don't know, you want to say thank you to a friend for introducing you to the show, or happy birthday, or propose to your future spouse, I don't care. I'll do that for you.
Yeah, I think that's ideal. You do have access right now to two people who have proposed and been accepted. So you really can't go wrong.
Three times.
Wait, you proposed three times?
No, you have.
Only two times.
Yeah, but three times.
Oh, three times altogether. Us, yes. Yeah. I have had two accepted proposals. Yes.
You've got a lot of experience.
And at $100 per month, we will read whatever ad you want each and every episode.
Don't do that. That's too much money.
Yeah, and also we don't want to read an ad.
And we don't really want to be beholden to one person that much.
Right.
But if you are a company or something and you have a big project to sponsor, it's out there.
Hey, yeah. So if you are listening to us right now and you're sitting at home and going, you know what? I've got like $5 extra a month that I'm not doing anything with.
Yeah, I could give up my latte.
So think about it. And if you can really spare that money, I highly encourage you to give it to the ACLU. because they could really use that donation right now.
That's fair. If you have $10 a month.
Right. If you've got an additional $5 on top of that, please give it to Planned Parenthood. Okay. Because they also really need that money. Now, if you have $5 more over that, maybe consider giving it to us.
That's a good point. Now, if you have $110 a month, I've got a whole list of charities that you should fund before us.
I think we should do this every time we talk about Patreon. Here's two more charities for you. Right. Also us.
Anyway, this is absolutely optional for everybody. We aren't expecting anything from any of our listeners, and the show will continue to go on in its current format, uninterrupted. 6 a.m. every Thursday, no problem, regardless of what happens with Patreon. We're just hoping that this will be a cool way to engage with our listeners and also get some new content put out there that you guys have been asking for about 2 years.
Yeah, and we're always still available on Twitter or email messages if you just want to get in contact with us directly.
Yeah, I assure you there will be no priority access through Patreon because we are bad at responding to things, especially emails, across the board. But if you do have any questions, email totalpartythrill@gmail.com or Twitter at TPTcast are probably the easiest ways to get us.
So speaking of email and Twitter questions, this is a mailbag episode.
It is. Would you like to start with Twitter, Ishan? Because those are much shorter.
Sure, let's knock them out.
Okay.
First question comes from Voyager at Mumfrey999. Any subjects that you'd like to revisit because your perspectives have changed over the course of 1 to 99 episodes? I gotta say, I don't... Hashtag no regrets, right? Like, I ain't gonna take nothing back. No, I don't think there's anything where I can look back and say, oh, I wish I had said something different. There are some early episodes where I kind of wish we didn't bite off so much in one single episode. Like we did, I think episode maybe 12 was The Social Contract.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like we get so many questions about that. And like when I'm on like a Reddit or something, I see so many people throwing out questions that just have to do with a basic misunderstanding of the social contract and what it means to like have fun in a group of people.
Right, right.
So, I mean, that's something I would want to expand on more. I mean, maybe we'll end up doing that by sort of pulling out a smaller part of that and expanding it into a full episode.
Yeah, that's funny because that was also the episode that I would like to revisit. Ironic.
Is it ironic?
It is, because that's the episode we submitted for the Ennies last year. And that got us a nomination, I believe.
I thought it was the dwarf episode.
We submitted a couple.
We did take your pick.
Didn't quite follow the rules, but that was one of the episodes that we had sent for the Ennies, and we got nominated, and that was amazing. And thank you for everybody who voted for us. But I feel like it's such an important topic. I think we should revisit it if. For no other reason than just as like a good friendly reminder of like, here's a fresh episode to point people to if you have questions or problems or whatever. And mm-hmm. I would love to get in that kind of case by case sort of situation too. Maybe like troll through Reddit and see if we can't find some truly egregious social contract questions.
Yo, there are some super creepy ones recently. So yeah.
Well, it's Reddit, so
yeah. We're not gonna look on 4chan.
No. So I think their social contract there is caveat emptor.
We kind of did the same thing with our initial playing non-human characters episode. You know, we then blew that out into all the different races, and that's been a really popular series.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Jane, next Twitter question.
This one comes from Tyler Diaz. That's Ziphon3 on Twitter.
Ziphon-e-e-e-e-e?
I accept. We've had Batman. How about forging Robin in general or a specific one, but I want the sidekick. And at the risk of seeming greedy by sending two requests, what party would you most like to play in made only of forges?
Too greedy. Rejected.
Well, let's start with Robin.
Okay.
I don't know anything about Robin other than he was a circus acrobat and he was in the movie that had the nipple suit.
Yeah, paging Dr. Howard.
Yeah.
So I think if we are making a D&D character, that is Robin. Early Robin is trying to be Batman, you know, so it's really just sort of a low-level Batman. I think our Batman was, Rogue Monk?
Yeah.
And that fits really well with Robin, right? Expertise in acrobatics, essentially. I mean, he should be actually better at acrobatics at the same level than Batman would have been.
Right.
The things that really differentiate Robin, though, in terms of a D&D build, is I would make sure that he has charisma as high as possible given the strictures of your build.
Mm.
Because even more so than Batman, Dick Grayson especially is like a leader. Batman kind of leads from the shadows, or like people do what Batman says, because if you don't do what Batman says, you're going to die. And it's not that Batman kills you, it's that you're an idiot for not following his instructions.
Right.
But like Dick Grayson stands in the front and says, like, do what I am going to do because you believe in me.
Okay, so trading out Batman's intelligence for Robin's charisma.
Yeah, I mean, Robin is still very smart, and particularly later Robins are sort of like very technically proficient, but that's not really something you model well in D&D.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, maybe like tool proficiencies, you know. But yeah, I think the build is generally the same with more of an emphasis on charisma and maybe slightly less emphasis on wisdom or dexterity, whatever you think you can spare, mechanically speaking.
Okay.
Second part of the question, Shane, if you had to build a D&D party made only of character creation forge entries, what would it be?
So we joked about this before we started recording that I would just take six of the gambler. and then you reminded me that if you take six, then the DM is going to scale up the difficulty. So mm-hmm. you should only take five. So that's fair. I would take a party of five gamblers. And then I was thinking about it, and I'm really missing an opportunity to get the spell duelist, who is the counterspell specialist, which is a super strong build.
Mm-hmm.
So I would throw that one in there. And then I think I would throw the Warhammer 40K Inquisitor in as well.
So the Inquisitor and then a warband of acolytes.
Basically.
Yeah. Yeah, I dig it.
And then there were a couple other like sort of goofy and fun ones that I wouldn't mind.
Polymorph fromage. It seems like you're going for the broken builds anyway.
Yeah. Let's go with the polymorph fromage. It's a party of mages and one inquisitor.
An inquisitor who's like, I will use every tool at my disposal.
Exactly. This is a rampant pragmatism.
It's a radical, right? It's not technically against the rules. I'm using rules as written of the ecclesiarchy.
No, that's interesting. I think I would go for more of like a monodominant, like a very hard line, puritanical approach to the Inquisition, because I have all of these tools at my disposal. If I took a radical approach, I would quickly upset the balance of power.
So
only faith can sort of rein in our clear ability to rule the world.
Also, it's very much like a Puritan to be like, polymorph, disintegrate.
Yeah.
What's a trial?
I'm going to turn you into a steak so I can burn you. How about you? What's your party?
I think I'm going to go with Team America. So Captain America.
Okay.
Batman.
All right.
The Two-Fisted Archaeologist, Indiana Jones, not Lara Croft.
Oh, because Lara Croft was British,
right?
Yeah, I believe that's right.
Yeah. The Highway Ronin, because only really in America do you have these long stretching highways with someone on a motorcycle who like has to walk around righting wrongs.
Mad Max was Australian, but that's fine.
He wasn't really righting wrongs.
Definitely Australian, though.
Yes. I guess Patagonia as well. You could do this. I'm going with the Highway Ronin.
Okay, fine. The Route 66 Ronin, if you will.
Okay, let's go with that. And to really round out America, I think the scum-sucking lawyer needs to be the final member of the group.
Yeah, this is less Team America and more Team Americana.
Sure, yeah, I'll take it.
Okay.
Yeah. They could all be star-spangled.
Yeah.
Except for Batman.
Right, yeah, he's
right, no,
still
mm-mm.
dark and brooding.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. All right, so now let's move on to the email questions.
Wait, we have one more question from Twitter.
Oh, yeah, it came in like an hour ago, and we've been doing this for like 3 hours.
Yeah.
All right, we can let's splice this back into the Twitter section.
Okay.
That's why we sound way more drunk,
yep.
because we are.
Do it.
Way more drunk. All right, Janine X at the Rummy YJ says, "What are your thoughts on food at the gaming table? Any recommendations?"
First of all, I think it's the Rummy J.
I thought I said no. There's no YJ.
There's no YJ.
Oh, you're just right. It's just the Rummy J. Look, I may have had a few drinks.
We may have recently recorded that terrible, terrible song. So thoughts on foods at the gaming table. Nothing that leaves stuff on your fingers, because that gets into books and character sheets and all over the place.
Yeah, it sort of sounds weird to say, but I lean away from things like Cheetos and Doritos, like the traditional D&D finger foods.
Even though I would love to eat them all the time at game night, I don't. Those are the worst foods to eat.
Well, you eat those? They don't have any protein. I'm confused.
Okay, yeah, fair enough. I think if you're going to do like those kind of snack foods, candy is probably actually a little bit better, like a bowl of M&Ms or something, or like peanut M&Ms are good. But I think just in general, if you want something a little bit healthier, maybe hummus and like pita chips or guac and tortillas.
Yeah, those are great for, you know, essentially party food, right? People to sort of share, you know, with regular tortilla chips that aren't going to leave a ton on your fingers. So we game in like downtown Manhattan,
which means we have delivery of every cuisine you can imagine.
Every single possible thing.
Yeah, available without having to call a single person. It's all on the internet.
And I know that's not typical, but like if that's a situation that you're in, I think the only things you really need to consider are space. Again, in Manhattan, we have less space than most people have, I think. But you want something that isn't going to make a big sloshy mess. So like soups or even something like a curry or a ramen is less convenient, simply because you need to be a lot more careful. And, you know, if you do spill, like, it's possible that you ruin a battle map or somebody's expensive mini or their...
Or someone's kitchen table.
Yeah. Well, I don't care about your kitchen table.
Yeah, well, I do.
or, you know, a character sheet, right? You can replace it, but it's a pain in the ass.
Or a phone or laptop, or that's actually something to be more concerned about.
Yeah. Also, you want to think about smell. I tend to avoid seafood at game night.
Yeah. Pizza is great.
Yeah.
Especially if you live in a city that doesn't do deep dish pizza. So all the good cities.
Right, because that's not pizza.
Right.
That's like cheese and tomato cake.
It's tomato soup in a bread bowl, as Jon Stewart once said.
Also, you have to use your hands to eat the pizza, but that's fine.
Yeah. If you have foods like that where it's hand food and it could be messy, I would just make sure you keep napkins close at hand, because you don't want that getting everywhere. And as a guest at somebody's house, maybe pick up a napkin and wipe off your hands.
Right. Do that before you move the mini,
right?
Or like point on the battle map,
right?
Fingerprints
or left. Touch their upholstered chair.
I think if you're in a more traditional D&D scenario, you're in the suburbs, you're in a basement, you have a lot more room. When we were actually at Angelo and Susie's place before you joined the group, they would like make food.
Oh,
before we showed up. And then we would take like a, you know, 15-minute break halfway through. Everyone would go like grab some food, eat a bit, and then take their food back to their places, and we'd continue playing.
Yeah, I've heard about people who cook for their guests.
It's difficult in Manhattan. The other thing that I used to do back in high school, which I think probably a lot of our listeners may still be able to do, is like we gamed all night, mm-hmm. you know? So we would take like an hour break at like 2 in the morning, hop in a car.
Go to Taco Bell.
Or the 7-Eleven, or literally the grocery store, and like actually buy food, maybe in like frozen pizza. We make some frozen pizza. The gas station nachos, those happened a lot. Although I'm pretty sure a dude died from botulism in California from gas station nacho cheese. So maybe avoid that.
Good Lord.
No, it's like my worst fear is dying from some ridiculous thing in my obit.
You should. Well, you do avoid pork.
Trichinosis
is like the worst.
But just poorly canned green beans. Those could be my undoing at any point.
The Jolly Green Giant strikes again.
So yes, food at the table, yes, because you need to keep people fueled in order to actually play this game.
Yep.
Just be considerate like a normal human being.
Also, if you are a guest at somebody's place, it's very easy to just pick up a bag of something that you can share with everybody every once in a while, just to be like, hey, thanks, here's some stuff for the group.
Yeah.
Same goes for alcohol, which we also fully endorse at the table. We would not be friends with all of our friends if we didn't have it.
I have a tough time GMing an entire session without any booze.
Yeah. I've taken to GMing a lot of sober sessions when you guys get housed. And I'm kind of enjoying it a lot.
It's one or the other, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, you don't want to be in between.
I think the last session of Morning Glory, I was like, I can't drink. I got to make this come together.
I got to fit it all. Right. I got to make it work. I got to remember this.
Definitely other sessions where I was like, I don't have a lot planned.
Yeah.
I should definitely get drunk and we'll just see what happens.
We'll socialize a lot.
And sometimes those are the most fun sessions. There's a lot of, yeah, I guess I'll allow it.
Right. Many a ponderous pause.
Thank you, Janine. Great question.
Yeah, so we got a good number of email questions, and all of them had very kind words and congratulations and thank yous and everything associated with it. We appreciate that. Thank you so much for writing those kind words, but for the sake of brevity, we're going to not read those.
Yeah. In the future, though, if you want to pay us to read them, we certainly will.
I suppose, yeah. All right, so our first email comes from Scott, who is at VriskaChat on Twitter. So Scott is, just a little bit of background from his email. He's playing an Inquisitorial Sorcerer, starting Rogue One, Dragon Sorcerer 2. So he's following the Brand Talandro build.
He will come to no good end.
He's concerned about multiclassing, delaying his sorcerer abilities, and feeling behind the rest of the party. So he asks, multiclassing is a staple in the character creation forge, where you want those characters to be playable from 1 to 20, but you rarely discuss how to actually break it up. I'd appreciate a discussion on the actual nuts and bolts of playing and leveling up a multiclass character and any pitfalls to avoid beyond stopping short of milestones and ASIs.
So we've mentioned a bit of this before, but in general, you want to avoid delaying the ability score increase that you get at level 4. Because likely you're going to be pumping that into your main stat, or you'll be getting a feat that's crucial to your build.
Mm-hmm.
Also, pretty much every character class gets a substantial bump in power at level 5, so you want to delay that as little as possible. But a lot of it is going to depend on, one, your playstyle, right? Are you someone who needs to feel powerful at every level, or do you have a very particular character concept that you need to multiclass in order to feel like you actually are that character?
Mm-hmm.
Fortunately, like, a lot of spellcasters get the bump in power from their cantrips. Like, at level 5, they scale.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, cantrips are character level, not class level.
Yeah, I'm going through this exact same thing in our Dark Sun game. I've got a multi-classed druid eldritch knight, and I need both of those classes in order to feel like I'm the character that I want to play, which is like a psionic gladiator who like rediscovers a druidic heritage, mm-hmm. you know? So that meant that I needed to start with one of the classes and then immediately multiclass into the other.
Right.
And then to really feel like I had any sort of druidic abilities and to get the wild shape to, you know, feel like I had an iconic ability, I felt like I needed to go to druid 3.
Yep.
But that really delayed fighter abilities. Yeah. Right. So now I'm level 6. I am Eldritch Knight 3, where I finally really have some like
You're
spells.
An Eldritch Knight.
Right. And Druid 3. But that means that I have 0 ability score increases at yep. level 6. I have level 2 spells at level 6.
Yep.
And I don't have extra attack. And I'll be perfectly honest, it's kind of tough right now. You know, like in combat, that's my main thing is smash things with a shillelagh, but I can only do it once around unless I drop out that action surge.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just sort of like dealing with it until Druid 4, I'm getting an ASI, and Fighter 4, I'm getting an ASI. So what's going to happen is I will be slow for like levels 3 through 7 and then like a sudden surge in power.
Yeah, that's a really long delay though. 'Cause
yeah.
I mean, we generally say don't delay more than a level or two to get to level 5 in a class, because level 5 is sort of where that next tier ability comes from, either mm-hmm. third level spells or extra attack or the equivalent. And when you delay that, you're kind of slowing down when you enter that next tier of play. And I feel like that is a little easier to feel and see at the table when everyone else gets to roll d20s twice and you don't.
Yeah, I think it's definitely a trade-off that you have to decide what you're comfortable with.
Right.
It would have been much much more mechanically optimal for me to take Fighter 1 Druid 5 or Fighter 5 Druid 1. I would still have the flavor. I would mostly be role-playing the aspects of the other class, but then I would have extra attack, or I would have level 3 spells, plus a better wild shape.
Yeah.
But I'm a sucker for punishment.
Yeah, apparently. You're playing Dark Sun.
Yeah.
But as to why we don't discuss this in every single character creation forge, one, we're often running short on time, and we're trying to cover it completely as possible in the time we have allotted. And two is just that it gets very repetitive to always be saying the same thing. So, you know, I would rather give you some guiding principles rather than specify that on each and every build.
Right. So specifically to Scott's question, if you're multi-classing a rogue and a sorcerer, what would your early levels breakdown be?
Okay, so it's interesting because Brand was a sorcerer rogue, but because I started that build late, I never actually had to play through the early levels of it. So I didn't have to deal with that split. But in Dark Sun, I am also playing a spellcaster rogue.
Huh.
Yeah. A bladesinger swashbuckler. And so I think with that build, the problem you have is when you get to level 5, you don't have your third level sorcerer spells. But your rogue is, if you go rogue 1, sorcerer 4, as he's planning, as Brand was, you're not going to have sneak attack high enough to feel like a good melee character because you'll only get one attack. You also won't have third level spells, so you'll feel like you're sort of stuck in between being like, you know, a full caster and also being a competent rogue. So you're going to end up relying on cantrips. And if you're a dragon sorcerer, that's probably going to be whatever the elemental cantrip is for your dragon. I was fire, so that was firebolt. That gives you pretty good damage, but isn't quite as exciting as attacking multiple times or getting to drop fireball or haste or, you know, those fly, you know, all those kind of fun spells.
Mm-hmm. But remember that there's a reason you multiclass in the first place. With Rogue One, you've got two expertises, so you are going to be more highly skilled than most of the other characters in the party. So lean more heavily on those in opportunities when you can use those skills. And keep flinging that firebolt.
Yeah.
that's what I'm also doing. I guess I produce flame.
Wow.
Yeah.
Produce flame's also not a great cantrip.
No, it's not great. It's very flavorful, though.
It is very flavorful. I also have produce flame.
All right. Our next question comes from Snark Knight. Number one, do you each have a favorite published adventure and why? Shane, I think I know your answer.
I own exactly one published adventure at this point in my life. It is Expedition to the Barrier Peaks.
That is not what I was going to guess.
No. I like that because it's so weird and it has this kind of strange place in D&D history, and that's why I own it. But
it's very strange. Is it spoilers? It's been out for so long.
It's been out for 20 years, 30 years.
Spaceships.
Yeah, you go to the Barrier Peaks in Greyhawk and find a spaceship has crashed, and the dungeon map is literally a spaceship layout. It was a tournament module.
Does it ever say who ran the spaceship, like what race or whatever?
I don't recall off the top of my head.
I'm just going to go with Mind Flayers, because I think that actually makes sense. Mind Flayers, if anyone, Mind Flayers would have spaceships.
Yeah, sure.
Which they stole from the Nyogi, I guess.
Okay. but I think my favorite is actually Sunless Citadel.
Yeah.
It was the first published adventure that I ever ran for other people, and it was also the first adventure I ran for other people that was even moderately successful.
No Bule.
Yeah, no Bulets suddenly murdering people in an arena. No rogue sneak attacking from behind as they went into the den of thieves. Like, it was the first one that kind of showed me a path for how to structure adventures. And it had Meepo, the amazing kobold who, like, you could befriend and would walk you through all the hard sections up front. And it was great. It was a great meta plot. I love that. Bruce Cordell wrote that one as well.
It also has one of my least favorite magic items.
Shatter Spike.
Yeah.
Fair enough. It was really good if you wanted to sunder things.
And then not get that loot.
Right. Yeah. So what about you, Ishan?
I think it's probably no surprise to regular listeners, but my favorite module would have to be Dead Gods.
The Planescape module.
Mm-hmm, from Monty Cook.
Oh, convenient. We just talked about that. Otherwise, I would have forgotten about it.
It's kind of a sequel to The Great Modron March, which I also love. It's, you know, set mostly in Planescape. I will say, I have never run Dead Gods. I have only played through it on multiple occasions, and I've loved it every time. At least one time was not the original second edition, but like a homebrewed fourth edition version. And then a fifth edition campaign that was sort of heavily drawn from it. It has such an amazing storyline. You need to change a lot in order to make it not a wipe in certain areas, but like such is second edition.
Yeah.
It's so good for world building. And just the craziness and the weird stuff that can happen to the characters while still making them feel like they're really accomplishing something and, you know, saving things, I think to me is sort of like classic quintessential D&D.
Cool. So Snark Knight's second question. I've rewritten this question three times. Maybe this is more of an episode suggestion, but how do you deal when the PCs lose? Like, for example, my group almost got TPK'd by a dragon and they ran away. I have a bunch of things that I can improvise to happen, but I want them to feel like the situation is now worse without the dragon chases you and kills you in your weakened state, which is no fun for anyone.
I think this is a good idea for an episode.
Mm-hmm. But let's try and condense it into about 2 minutes.
Well, briefly, you fail forward.
Right.
The characters have screwed up in some way. And so that needs to then present them with new opportunities for maybe more screwing up or for finding a different way around the obstacle to get to the goal they were originally reaching for.
I like the idea because it's a dragon and because dragons are cruel and intelligent. Maybe the fact that they escaped has endeared them a bit, and the dragon chases them down, but instead of killing them, he presses them into his service.
Yeah, no, so, I like that a lot.
So now they have to figure out how to do whatever they were trying to do while also wrestling their way out from under the thumb of this incredibly evil, incredibly powerful creature.
Mm-hmm. If that derails your campaign too much, again, remember the dragon is intelligent. Maybe killing obviously weak PCs is not worth its time because dragons hate leaving their horde.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for all this dragon knows, like it's been around, what, 1500 years, it may think they're just the decoys. It leaves to chase them, it eats them, it has a full belly, and it comes back, and the actual adventurers have robbed its hoard.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. He might actually hire somebody to mm-hmm. go square up with these adventurers because he's not willing to actually leave his hoard.
Yeah. So you certainly have multiple options. The other thing to consider is what is it that the PCs were trying to accomplish when they came across this dragon in the first place? Like, were they trying to retrieve the hoard, or was the dragon just sort of in the way of their other goal?
If I know PCs, they were after the hoard.
On the way to some larger goal.
Right? Yeah, on the way to the larger goal of being really, really rich and retiring from adventuring.
If you think about Lord of the Rings, the Fellowship is trying to get on the other side of the Misty Mountains, and they're like, oh, well, we should take the pass, and there's too much snow. Well, we can't go too far south because Saruman is there.
Mm-hmm.
Crap. I guess we have to go through Moria. Like, yeah. This is an opportunity to be like, well, you know that thing you didn't want to do? Guess you're doing that thing.
Right, right. And then I think worst case scenario is the dragon chases them down and strips them nude and takes all of their stuff, right? If it's maybe a younger dragon or something like that, just they lose their gear, and I think that's plenty of punishment for losing a fight where the dragon wouldn't really gain anything from killing them.
Yeah, sometimes like loss is much worse than death, or even shame.
Oh, I'll tell you, lose a hand in your game.
Did that happen?
It happened. Oh yeah, that happened to Brand. Yeah, he lost a hand.
I feel like you were more upset by losing the shield and the wand of shield.
I was super upset from losing like half of my build. Like, I had put feats into being able to have a shield, and now I had no hand to equip a shield.
So, I mean, I think this actually has something to do with this question is, I knew that was a possibility that you might lose a hand, and I knew that it was integral to your build. We were about to go into a section of the story that was very little combat, mostly talking, and then at the end of that relatively short arc, you were going to get your hand back. Mm-hmm. I knew that. You didn't know that. I sort of enjoyed watching you squirm. Enjoy watching your player squirm for a little while.
Yeah, but fair. Yeah, be cognizant that if they feel super underpowered, they're going to get very conservative or potentially very catty with you.
Yeah, or just give up and like lose interest in the storyline.
Yeah.
Okay, our next question comes from Tim. I'm running a completely homebrewed campaign. The world is very large and broken up into 5 continents, each of which is ruled by a chromatic dragon as a tyrant.
I like it. I like it.
Yeah, that's a great world. I mean, to play in, right? Not to live in.
Right.
That's why I'm not playing a peasant.
Right.
So his question is, he has 5 friends who are not currently playing the game that he has asked to create the personalities of each of those dragons, you know, how they keep control of their continents, and he's given them complete control over how the dragons react to the world as the players are interacting with it. So essentially, he has 5 friends who are role-playing the dragons.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if the party is destroying a blue dragon hatchery, he says, and they smash all the eggs, he goes and asks his friend, what does the blue dragon do in response? They can also, like, form alliances with other dragons. Essentially, they're playing Dragon Risk.
Right.
And then you have this other party operating in that world.
Exactly.
So he asks, you know, have you heard of anything like this? And am I biting off more than I can chew? I was hoping that having dynamic villains outside my own head would create a more rich environment. Plus, I don't have to create as much. But he's afraid that it might fall flat. And notes that it's only the second campaign he's ever run.
So I have done something like this.
Oh, really?
Not to this extent. Not to the point where I had multiple people playing effectively, like you said, Dragon Risk, right? I think that can be very difficult because the disparity in resources and the lack of investment from the dragon players, like, they don't have an eye towards what makes for a good story for your actual campaign, mm-hmm. right? So I think that can be a challenge. But something that I do, and even in the Dynasty Unwarranted campaign, the Rug Trader game that I'm running for our group, is I send a weekly recap of what happened, and I send that recap to a couple of my friends from home that I used to play games with. And I always ask a couple of them, I'm like, hey, what's a cool thing for this character to do in response to that? Right. And they know kind of what's going on. And I just solicit them for input because I'm, you know, I'm sometimes marred down in the details or I'm not thinking or whatever. And, you know, they've got like just a second opinion. And sure, sometimes they give me crazy off the wall ideas that I can't use. And other times they give me terrible, poorly like thought through ideas that wouldn't really fit the character. But other times they give me great ideas. And that's exactly what I do. Right. So sometimes you're dealing with the true randomness of somebody role playing your enemies, which I don't know that you've ever known that. And why would you? It's not important to you guys. The story that comes out of it is what's important. And I've curated that.
It makes sense that we've been fighting Southern frat bros this entire time.
Yeah. So these were all friends before that.
Oh,
these are all friends from high school.
Uh oh.
Proper nerds, thank you.
They're like, I'm surprised they haven't sent a boule after us.
Not yet.
I think what Tim has done is he's basically running 2 separate games at the same time, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you're asking your friends, hey, give me some input. What do you think a character would do in this situation? But Tim is saying, hey, what does your character do in this situation?
And I think those people being asked that question are expecting that to become true.
Right. Right.
They're not offering input. They're telling it how it is.
If they are, it's going to be actually really hard to balance the needs of both parties. And then also like the dragons with each other, right? Because now you're getting into almost too many protagonists.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Do the dragons know that they're supposed to lose in the end?
Yeah, that's the other part of this, is that the dragon story is wholly unimportant to your campaign.
Especially 5 of them.
Right.
Like, if there was one player and one dragon sort of controlling on a macro level all of the quote-unquote evil forces, that's something that I could see being easier to manage. Now, if you have a conversation with the 5 dragon players and say, hey, you know, like, I'm looking for your input on what you think would be cool and interesting in this scenario more than, hey, what does your dragon character do? Because, of course, if you ask them the latter, they are invested in keeping the dragon alive.
Mm-hmm.
rather than having a cool story. And they're invested in amassing territory. So the story is really going to become about the dragons fighting with each other or having alliances with each other.
Right.
And your relatively low-level party isn't going to matter much.
Yeah, to me, that's really the challenge that you have here is if you treat the dragons like players, they're going to want the agency of players. Mm-hmm. If you treat them as co-GMs, then they should take the more holistic view of what makes for a cool story, what makes for cool challenges for the campaign, what makes for a cool backdrop for the campaign, but not how do I win this game?
Yeah. I could even see also treating them as like fans of a TV show. Showrunner, and they are writing in with ideas about what they want to see happen to their favorite character or what they would do in the situation. You are not beholden to that advice.
Yep.
You make a story, and then you send them that story that should be enjoyable for them to read. They'll be like, oh, cool, I didn't expect that that would happen to this character,
right?
Or even my character, but that's pretty cool.
Yep. Actually, I think that's exactly right. It's great to have outside input, but you need to make the final decision on what happens.
Yeah. In the same way that you would if you're just dealing with a regular party.
And you are trying to role play all five of them in your own head.
Yeah. Like, you know, if you have a PC who is noble born, they'll often say like, oh, well, my house does this, or like my father, the king, I think he would do this. But like, they don't get to decide what the king does. You decide.
Right, right. All right, next question. This comes from Jeff. My table consists of all new players to tabletop, and we've been playing 5e for the last 4 months.
Congratulations.
We've been playing with pre-gen characters in a generic setting this entire time, killing goblins and solving problems.
It's burn notice.
I would like to shift gears and put the campaign in Eberron. How do I introduce the setting to new players? Should I just do lore dumps each session by NPCs or what?
Okay, so first I want to say that if you have so far been killing goblins and solving problems, this is perfect to shift to Eberron.
You're basically in Eberron.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, get out of Goblin Land and into Sharn, and you're in Eberron.
We stumble out of Dargoon, and yeah. Actually, you're in Breland. You're actually within spitting distance of Sharn.
Right.
So I will say, first off, who wants to shift the campaign to Eberron? Like, Jeff, if it's you, that's cool, but do the rest of the players know anything about Eberron? It seems like they don't. So the first thing I would do is check with them, give them the elevator pitch of Eberron, and ask, is this a kind of campaign setting you're interested in playing in? Because it's not a traditional campaign setting.
Well, I hear you, but they're also new players, so what does traditional matter?
I mean, if they're thinking, oh, like, I'm going to play D&D. I hear it's like Lord of the Rings. Like, Eberron is not in Lord of the Rings.
Well, D&D isn't really Lord of the Rings either. I hate to break it to you. Like, after 4 months, I should be disabused of that notion.
All right, fine. Let's assume everyone's on board with Eberron.
Well, continue your thought. I won't interrupt you any further.
Please do. I think people enjoy that.
As you can tell, we're now on our second glass as we prepare for this musical review.
In this episode, we're both the jerk.
Please continue.
I don't think lore dumps is the way to go. I kind of, like, when Shane came aboard as Brand, the party was level 8, they were firmly in Eberron. I kind of did a lore dump with you because you didn't know anything about Eberron, but you kind of needed to get up to speed to where everyone else was.
And I was also a new player, so you could kind of, like, since I was, like, auditioning, you could kind of put that
Can
on
Can you
me.
Handle this?
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, it's something I probably would have done even if it wasn't Eberron, even if you were familiar with the setting, because I would just be doing, here's what happened in the campaign.
Right.
Yeah. But I think because everyone is new to Eberron, an easy way to do this is to have them be relatively provincial characters, people who, like, haven't traveled widely.
Yep.
They are from wherever you decide to set the beginning of this campaign. And then just give them, you know, information about the general wider world. Like, you're on a continent called Corvair. It's pretty big, and there was a freaking war.
Yep.
Low-level magic is, like, a thing, and you're all comfortable with that. Now, that said, you're all from Ondaer. You've all been from Ondaer and you've never left Ondaer. So here's actually a fair amount of information about Ondaer.
Actually, I don't know that you even need to go that far. I mean, you could actually play the players as their characters, right? Of, they might not have realized that they're actually in Eberron, right? Find the place in Corvair where you could fit them in, where they've been fighting goblins or whatever, where you've got room to fit whatever town or people that they know, and then have somebody from outside come in and be like, hey, we're recruiting for the last war, by the way. Well, I guess it wouldn't be the last war yet. For the Hundred Years' War. Like, we're coming through to conscript.
I think that would work maybe in Zendrick.
You think there's too much information that's, like, widely available?
I think Corvair is too advanced for people not to know where they are.
Fair enough.
But it could totally work if they were a party of Saren barbarians.
Mm.
Like, all they know is we live on an island and there are dragon gods whom we see occasionally. But if then, like, I don't know, conquistadors, essentially,
yeah,
from Kabara show up.
Yeah, well, that would be... It's probably too far gone in their campaign for that.
If they're 4 months in, no, they're probably like as much as level 5.
Yeah, you might be right. It might be best to just kind of, you know, you've been focused in this little area of the map. Mm-hmm. Let me expand your view a little bit. But your characters already know this.
I bet it works as a pirate game, actually. If they're in the Lazar Principalities, they've either been on an island or on a ship or, you know, combination of both. Like, the Lazar Principalities are run by, like, pirate kings, not really Corvair as a whole. They weren't really involved in the last war. That actually could be characters who weren't involved in the war. And, you know, once they get to the real mainland, they're like, oh, wow, oh, really? 100 years? You're kind of idiots.
Oh, yeah, that's a good idea. Why did you do that? Yeah, and the Lazar Principalities don't have a huge political position in Eberron, right, either, so... Mm-hmm. Once you leave them, you don't have a great reason to go back.
Yeah. The other option would be the Shadow Marches. That's mostly humans and half-orcs, which should be fun. Just, you'd be peasants in the wilds fighting goblin tribes.
Yeah.
You know, you just hadn't been involved in it. Or you could all be gnomes from Zalargo.
Well, they're probably not an all-gnome party.
Maybe they should be.
I do like your Zenadric idea, because you could make Stormreach sort of that main... You know, the capital kind of place, right? The biggest city they know of. And when they get there, they realize that there's actually a whole lot beyond Stormreach.
Yeah, I mean, they could essentially be low-level adventurers in Stormreach, completely unconcerned with, like, this war happening on a distant continent. They're going into the jungles, killing goblin tribes and things like that. And then they find a patron or something kicks them up into the wider world.
Right.
And that gives them all this information that they didn't have before. Not that you need to dump it on them. You can just... They have the ability to go out and find that information now if they want.
Right, right. Yeah. No, I think that works well.
Cool. All right. Next question is from Steven. Well, it's less a question and more corrections, which are appropriate.
Okay. So Steven writes, I've noticed a couple of minor rules things that I think are important. One thing I noticed was that you guys kept on insisting that half-orcs get +1 dexterity. They do not. They get +1 constitution. Yeah, that's absolutely true. We completely screwed that up and just decided to leave the episode as it was.
I think it was already posted when we noticed it.
Yeah.
And we're like, ugh.
Yeah.
The parts where we're like, they're so graceful, just swap in the information we said in the dwarf episode.
Yeah, because
you're going strength con, right? I think I probably was the one who screwed that up in the first place, because...
You absolutely were. You wrote that episode. I'm breaking kayfabe.
You edited it. Okay.
I'm breaking kayfabe. I looked at that when we were recording it, and I was like, oh, I didn't know that. Why haven't I been playing more
it's
half-orcs?
It's because in 4th edition, they were strength decks. And I think there aren't any strength decks races, right?
I hope that Steven fact checks you and you're wrong again, and then we get another email that's like, shut up, Ishan, you don't know half-orcs.
We get a lot of those emails all the time. Yeah. Just basically, shut up, Ishan.
Yeah.
I get a lot of private DMs on Twitter.
From me.
And my mom. And your mom.
Great. Oh, dear. Okay. Steven continues. Another thing I just noticed in episode 81 is that you say that you do not need attribute requirements when multiclassing out of a class. The example I'm thinking of is, you say if you start rogue, you don't need the 13 dexterity. This is untrue. You need those statistic requirements whether you are going into or out of a class.
Steven is also correct here.
Uh-huh. Now that I think about these implications, what happens when you get polymorphed into a form that doesn't meet the requirements? Do you lose those abilities? Because you're supposed to retain them. Or like a druid, a multi-class druid.
So 3.5 had a clause that said if you no longer meet the requirements for a feat or a class feature, you lose that feat or class feature. I do not believe 5th edition has that stipulation.
So it's just a checkpoint when you level up.
I believe so.
Beautiful. So don't level up while in B-shape.
While polymorph's true.
Anyway, Steven is correct. You do need those requirements both directions. We have screwed that up in our relentless efforts to min-max.
Yes. So something to consider is that if you are choosing a first level class, but you do not meet the requirements for multiclassing, you are stuck in that class forever. Well, potentially forever. It's possible that you have minned your primary stats so low that no matter how many ASIs, you can't get out of it.
That's a fate worse than death.
I will say the vast majority of our 5e games eliminate the multi-class attribute requirement, and we haven't had any problems. I think it unfairly penalizes paladins and monks.
Yeah, I don't know. It doesn't make a huge difference.
It makes it hard when you're trying to reflavor a class.
That's true. The problem that you run into with things that are key to those abilities is that a lot of times, like, you can't go negative on your uses, right? So it's things like...
We have a minimum one.
Yeah, everything is like minimum one.
Fine.
Which makes it not worth taking often. So, like, I don't know. It's just silly.
Yeah, I could see, like, removing attribute requirements, making it easier to fall into a trap build that doesn't really work well for a
new
player.
Right. But, yeah, fair criticism. Well earned.
Maybe we'll introduce a corrections section.
No,
that would be all. That would be an entire episode's worth.
No,
every episode.
I'm like a goldfish. As soon as it posts, I forget it. All right. This is our next email from Tim.
Different Tim.
Not the same Tim. How strictly do you adhere to D&D's initiative rules? Have you run into situations where they don't model the story well? And if so, how have you dealt with that? For example, how do you model the deadliness of a hostage situation or a crossbow aimed at a character's back using standard initiative?
Well, first off, there is nobody in the entire world who strictly adheres to D&D's initiative rules because they rarely make sense all of the time.
Yeah, that's probably true.
That said, I think 5e does a pretty good job of it, so if you do try to play it by the book, for the most part, you should be okay.
I will say, so you made that flippant joke, and that's fair. The reason why is because D&D has this weird idea that you will, like, declare that you are in a combat encounter now, and everyone will roll initiative, and then we'll start, like, treating things like rounds. And to the example that Tim used, right, is at what point do you declare it combat? Right. At what point is this narrative action that's taking place within a scene versus within structured combat rounds? Right. Like, when do you go into that structured time? And I think that's sort of the question that drives the D&D challenge.
I think, yeah, people get tripped up when you're right at that point in which you're making the switch, right? Like surprise rounds, or like in this situation, obviously it's, If we were modeling according to the rules, someone has a crossbow at a hostage's back. They've essentially readied an action to shoot the hostage, right?
Right.
But I think the issue is not so much with the initiative rules, right? The story you're trying to tell is if the players do something that this person doesn't like, this hostage is going to die.
Right.
That scenario does not need to happen within the strictures of combat. Like, if the bad guy, the NPC that the GM is controlling, has a crossbow to an NPC, another NPC's back, they shouldn't have to roll to hit. They shouldn't roll damage, right? It's just if the PCs do the trigger that makes that person shoot, the hostage dies.
Right.
Like, you just narrate that. The hostage dies. You could be in rounds and the players are, you know, they're operating at different initiatives and they're making attack rolls and saving throws and all of that, but just the hostage dies.
Right. To get back to the original question of how strictly do we adhere, I would say only when it's convenient for the story. you know, if we have a fight that we know is coming and that we're, you know, everyone is planning on having this fight, then yeah, we roll initiative up front and we sort out our action economy in that order. I'm thinking of a lot of Rogue Trader situations where we're mid-negotiation and you could be drawing guns at any time.
That's why we all take quick draw.
Right. and in those situations, right, a lot of times it's like, okay, well, now we're going to do stuff, right? And or like in the hostage situation you mentioned, it could totally just be like, you know, do I have a chance to intervene or is it impossible for me to beat him drawing the trigger?
Right. And it's fine in that situation if you have players who then say, but wait, like I should have been able to do this, or I have this ability that allows me to do something else or to intervene.
Yep. And it's also fair for the GM to go, you're too far away.
Right.
Or like he won't let you get close enough that that could happen. Like, you know, it's just, if you do something, he's going to die.
Right.
That's what's going
to
happen.
Or to go, oh, that's a good point. I didn't think of that. Yeah, you intervene.
Right. I think when there are questions of the order of action, right, it's always best to try and find some mechanics that make sense. And I think the further afield you get from true initiative, the more lenient you need to be. And I think this is probably like allow some bargaining on the skills, mm-hmm. right? Like I like Star Wars, the Fantasy Flight Star Wars has their two kinds of initiative. Like there's the cool.
Oh, right. And then vigilance.
Vigilance, yeah. Right? Which is one is like you're paying attention and the other is just you're too slick to miss. So I could totally see the same thing where you could like, oh, but I'm smart. I would have anticipated this. Let me try intelligence to beat his dexterity to go first. Mm-hmm. Right? Something like that.
Another thing you can have in your back pocket. Remember, in 5e specifically, it is the GM who determines who is surprised at the beginning of combat.
Right.
So make your decision. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't do anything, you can't do anything, and you can't do anything because you're all surprised.
Right. That's also something we do a decent amount with D&D is that we actually start initiative with readied actions. As players, we'll try and lay traps a lot. And so we're like getting into position to spring the trap.
Oh, right? Yeah. I mean, we try to have ambushes as often as possible.
Right. Well, we're playing Dark Sun right now in D&D. So like we need every bit of help we can get.
Yes.
Often we end up getting scouted anyway.
Yeah, turnabout is fair play. Don't be too tactical or good at setting ambushes because your GM will learn from you.
Right. but yeah, I mean, I think the general takeaway, right, is initiative is a tool to structure the story. It's not meant to really restrict player action when you have cool things that could be going on.
Right, and it certainly doesn't need to restrict NPC action because you are the one that controls that.
Oh, right.
All right, these next questions come from Matt Perotti, friend of the show and a difficult question asker.
These are the hardest questions we get. He's like, oh, cool, I'll send my questions at the last minute and they'll all be stumpers.
All right, well, this one's definitely for you because I know nothing about video games. Matt says, this might be on the edge of your wheelhouse, but if the Character Creation Forge was in charge of a new Overwatch character, what would you make?
First of all, I would make us play 4th edition because 4th edition much better maps the archetypes that make sense in Overwatch.
You are a cruel, cruel GM.
I mean, I'm not going to make a character forge with 4th edition because that would take forever.
I'm sure I have an old one I can dig up.
Anyway, so similar to the 4th edition archetypes of, you know, tank and...
Defender, striker, controller, leader.
There you go. Overwatch has a similar sort of DPS, tank, defender, and support. Defense heroes are like more about area control.
Oh, okay.
They're like snipers and that sort of thing. So anyway, within Overwatch, I would say that one of the gaps is a support character who has control abilities, like area control abilities.
Okay. I'm feeling cleric.
Yeah, maybe something like that. It's tough to model. Overwatch also is based on MOBA, like so. The idea of ultimates.
I don't understand your acronym. I assume it's an acronym.
A different type of video game.
Okay.
But as you do things throughout the game, you charge a meter that gives you an ultimate ability that has a huge impact on the game.
Oh, it's Dragon Ball Z. Okay.
Yeah, kind of.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the game is very much about how you use and manage and build and team up and counter your opponent's ults.
Did you say alts?
Alts. ULT. Alts.
Alts. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Like alt right and.
No, that's alt. Sorry, I'm from Georgia.
I'm trying. You should always counter an alt-right. Okay. As often as you can.
Anyway, I would go for a more kind of control-y sort of support or something. I don't know. Whatever. I don't know how that would fit.
Control
into
support.
Yeah. But I did build Farah, one of the DPS characters.
Fawcett? Oh, okay.
Yeah. Era Kokra, Dragon Sorcerer with Elemental Adept and Spell Sniper. There you go.
Redundant wings, man.
Yeah, I know, but not to level 14.
Cool.
At level 6, you have all of Farah's abilities. You get Firebolt and Scorching Ray are your rockets. Thunder Wave is your Repelling Blast. And Fireball, I guess, is your ultimate, your barrage.
Fireball's pretty ultimate, actually.
Yeah.
It's pretty sweet.
There you go.
Did you say snipers are like controllers?
Okay, let's just cut that question.
No, it's good.
Sorry,
it's
Matt.
Good. There are people who listen who play video games. I'm just not one of them. But I'm also not a listener.
I never
listen to the show.
All right, Ishan. What IP do you think needs an actual play?
Okay, I think we have a consensus, right? Like we agreed on
Firefly.
This. Yeah,
Firefly.
Absolutely Firefly.
Yeah, we need Firefly.
Of course. I don't know of any. If there are some, let us know so we can listen to them.
Also, ideally not using the Margaret Weiss Firefly rules.
Yeah, either one of them.
Yeah.
Yeah, no Cortex.
Yeah.
I will also throw in Star Trek. I don't think enough people play Star Trek RPGs. I have literally never played a Star Trek RPG.
That's because they suck and Star Trek is dumb.
Ooh, you're half right.
Nobody cares about Luke Skywalker or Darth Vader. Star Trek is dumb.
Again, you're half right. And the three-parter from Matt. If one wanted to run a game in the universe of Saga comics, which rules systems do you think would be the best?
Oh, yeah. That's definitely Gamma World 7th Edition. Or, second option, the original werewolf from White Wolf Games.
Wow, you really thought about this.
I don't know anything about Saga. I have no clue if that's true. Is that right?
It is woke Star Wars.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know what that means.
It's a space opera, like fantasy, where there's like magic, and it centers around this like interspecies family that's like running from racists, essentially.
Okay.
It's a graphic novel.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Well,
Gamma World might work.
Yeah, no, I think Gamma World would work great.
Werewolf probably less so.
I mean, anything that's sort of like powered by the apocalypse, I think, because Saga is much more about the interactions of characters and like how they respond to each other than it is about particular power sets.
Mm.
Fate, I think, would be perfectly fine.
So wouldn't Cortex actually work for that?
Yeah, but I don't want to play Cortex.
Yeah, fair enough.
Or Savage Worlds. I also think that Fantasy Flight's Edge of the Empire would work here. The magic is relatively low level, and the fact that you never really totally succeed and never really totally fail works with the kinds of stories that you'd be telling in a Saga setting, I think.
Great. I will take that at face value.
All right. So there you go, Matt. Are you happy?
You tried to stump us. All right. Our final set of questions, I guess. Our final email of the day. This is from Cameron, not our Cameron.
Our Cameron, why don't you ever email us?
Yeah, he never emails. He never even RSVPs.
It makes us sad.
All right. First question. How would you go about statting an Athasian dragon in 5e? That's a dragon from Athas, Dark Sun. Would a reskinned ancient dragon with some spellcasting abilities and a few buffs work, or are there other things to take into account?
This is such a good question.
Yeah, so Athasian dragons were prestige classes and epic destinies and those sorts of things from prior editions.
Right. In the fiction, however, it is wrong to say Athasian dragons.
Yeah,
because there is
one.
Yes. His name is Boris.
He's
literally
the,
Boris.
The dragon.
The dragon of Tyr is his name. So all of the Sorcerer Kings who are defilers, right? They use arcane magic to draw in extra power from the world and life around them, and then use that to fuel their magic. That is slowly turning them into dragon-like creatures. But they're not really dragons. The only one who's sort of completed his apotheosis and turned into an actual dragon is Boris. And he went insane when he did it.
Yeah, he's almost like too powerful to really be an NPC.
I believe in 4th edition he was CR 30, the same as the Tarrasque. He is canonically the strongest thing in the setting.
Right.
You know, I mean, unless what's his name gets released from his prison, but even then he's sort of like a plot device, honestly.
Right.
If I was going to stat, you know, the strongest thing in the setting, you just sort of take the strongest thing in the setting and give it abilities that it needs to match the fiction. So,
well, conveniently, the strongest thing in 5th edition is not strong enough. So, so we can start with the Tarrasque.
There you go.
And then what are we going to add to it?
Wings.
Okay.
You need some wings.
Flying Tarrasque.
Mm-hmm. And then spellcasting.
Lots of spellcasting.
Yeah. So there is an option for high-level dragons in the Monster Manual to give them spellcasting abilities. I think it is one spell from any level equal to their charisma modifier, I think it is. Go ahead and do that. And you don't necessarily have to stat it off charisma. It could be intelligence or wisdom because Boris is also a high-level psionicist.
Yeah, I think you could literally just take the whole dragon ability section and just paste it into the Tarrasque and be fine.
Yeah. And then I would choose, I mean, his charisma or intelligence is probably what, like 26, maybe even higher than that.
Yeah.
So you're looking at 8 or 9 spells. Most of them are going to be high level. And then I would also layer on top of that psionic versions of the same thing. So give them another 8 or 9 spells, but they don't require components to cast.
Yeah, I don't know how much components really ever make a difference for an NPC villain like that.
But it does give your players the opportunity to figure out, oh, he's like using psionics, which means he can't defile when he does that.
Right, yeah, that's basically what it is. You're giving him 2 sets of spellcasting. One of them defiles constantly, and
right.
The other does not.
The thing I would probably do is when he casts like a high-level arcane spell, and he may only have high-level arcane spells, just automatically have him cast, like, not even cast, like, a circle of death goes off
right
in his radius, and that's his defiling.
Yeah, I like the idea of him having like 5th or 6th level spells, like basically at will.
Yeah.
And then the regular sort of limitations on higher than that.
Right. And if that sounds crazy, I mean, honestly, a 20th level party would rather have a 5th level spell chucked at them than deal with a full round of attacks from a CR 30 dragon.
Yeah, for sure.
/ Tarrasque.
And it's like, you've got to roleplay this too, right? He's insane. He's not a tactician.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's going to be brute force to get what he wants.
Right. And, you know, if he starts getting hurt, great. He flies a mile in the air and bombards you.
Right. Or falls. I bet he could take that damage better than you can.
If this sounds like it's totally overkill, believe me, level 20 parties in 5th edition D&D can easily handle a CR 30 creature.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you really got to buff them up, especially if you have any kind of magic items.
And also, if you're going against an Athasian dragon, you have a pretty good expectation that you're not coming out the other side intact.
Yeah. Yeah. This should be a battle that even if you win, you're going to lose.
Mm-hmm.
If you do want to stat the Sorcerer Kings who are on their way to becoming Athasian dragons, I think essentially high-level spellcasters work perfectly fine.
Yeah, or high-level dragons.
Yeah. Actually, you would need to tone down their physical stats. So maybe like one of the weaker dragons, white or bronze.
Yeah. Yeah. I would maybe take the physical stats of a younger dragon.
Yeah. Like a young adult.
Yeah.
Yeah. That sounds about right. And then slap on some spellcasting. Maybe mix them with the Archmage NPC.
Right. Or I guess you could buff up the Illithids as well.
Ooh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Depending on kind of what level you want them going after Sorcerer Kings.
I mean, now we have higher level Illithids out of Volo's Guide.
Oh, yeah. That would be, especially the undead one, I think, would work really well.
And be super creepy.
Yeah.
All right, and Cameron has one more question. With the Warhammer Fantasy RPG line being picked up by Cubicle 7 for a 4th edition, heavily inspired mechanically by the original and 2nd edition, what do you think the odds are of the 40K games getting similar treatment? Could we really get Rogue Trader 2nd edition?
So, I gotta be honest, I don't know anything about Cubicle 7's games. I mean, I know that they print the One Ring RPG, and I know that people play the One Ring RPG. I just don't know anything about it mechanically, so I'll take it at face value that they're pretty good from a game design perspective. And if they're gonna do that, if they're gonna bring in some of those original 2nd edition designers, like, I'm I'm sure they can get Rob Schwab or Chris Primus to work on it. I think it's going to be a really good game. They definitely do a great job from a production value standpoint, which is something that Fantasy Flight also paid a lot of attention to.
I mean, we really hope that we're getting a second edition Rogue Trader, because you're still cobbling it together from the first edition.
I would be okay if we never got a second edition Rogue Trader.
Really?
I mean, I would like to, don't get me wrong, because I like collecting new things and that's fine. But I am comfortable with where we are using Dark Heresy for Rogue Trader. Like, I'm fine homebrewing, like, one step ahead of you guys. It makes it a little more fun for me.
Oh, you don't want us reading through the book and going, here's how we can win.
Right. Yeah. I don't want to have to get system mastery ahead of six of you in a Warhammer 40K game. That said, I was curious that Fantasy got picked up first. I suspect that's because it was a lot cheaper, and Games Workshop is looking for a higher cost for the 40K license. That said, if you've paid attention to the tabletop, which, since you're asking about it, you maybe do, you know that they're releasing a new edition that's supposed to appeal more to longer-term 40K fans rather than the sort of drop $200, get disappointed, and quit crowd that they've cycled through for a long time. So hopefully the role-playing line comes into the fold with the new edition of 40K, and there's some valuable interaction there, and somehow somebody can maximize that.
If one of our listeners wants to sponsor us, maybe do a little VC investment, we will happily buy the license.
Yeah, I bet that's probably like, what do you think? 40K a year?
That's exactly what I was thinking.
We can pass the hat for that, right?
It's got to be a very big hat.
Yeah.
A hat of holding.
We're going to need a bigger hat. But yeah, I mean, I would love to see the 40K line active, if nothing else, because I enjoy collecting them and I enjoy reading anything in 40K fiction because I've never grown up past 14.
That's true. I will say that the Fantasy Flight books have set a pretty high bar in terms of the quality of the fiction and the illustration. A somewhat high bar in terms of the game design and the book construction.
They could be streamlined, for sure. There are definitely subsystems that are too complicated for what they offer to the game.
Yeah, but they really are beautiful books.
Yeah. All right, do you hear that, Ishan?
I'm furiously sewing a much bigger hat.
Well, then, let's...
Clicking thimbles.
Then we're going to need a head to put it on. Let's move on to the Character Creation Forge. But before we do that, let's talk about how our listeners can get in contact with us.
We do love hearing from you.
You can tweet at Shane, at Mundangerous, that's M-U-N dangerous.
And you can tweet at Ishan, at Evil Sans Carne, that's Malice minus Meat.
And you can tweet the show, at TPTcast.
You can also email us if you can fit it into 140 characters, at TotalPartyThrill@gmail.com.
And you can find us on the web at www.TotalPartyThrillCast.com.
We're also on Facebook and Instagram at Total Party Thrill.
So this week in the Character Creation Forge, we are building Baron Munchausen, which was suggested to us by listener David.
So there are many different versions of the Baron. He was originally based on an 18th century German aristocrat. Shane, will you please pronounce his name in your fine German accent?
My highly questionable German accent. Hieronymus Karl Friedrich, Freiherr von Munchausen.
It's very nice. Thank you, Wikipedia, for telling us how to pronounce things.
I kind of knew how to pronounce it. I also didn't pronounce his last name correctly. It's Munch.
Also, and this is probably stereotypical on my part, I did not know that you spoke any German. I just assumed.
Fair enough. My mother was born in Germany, so...
I just assumed.
White people, am I right?
All right, so the real life Baron was known for embellishing stories of his own bravery, but it was a 1785 book that catapulted the fictional version of the Baron into the collective imagination. And in the 20th century, we got like a dozen film or television adaptations of the character. The best known of which is, of course, Terry Gilliam's 1988 film, which we're basically using to base this build on.
Yeah, so one challenge with this is that he doesn't really have many concrete feats. He's got a lot of these, like, fantastic abilities that actually come from his companions and the people who he associates with.
Right. But the Baron is a masterful storyteller and a world-class Casanova.
Is that true? I mean, or is he just telling the story of how good of a Casanova he is?
Who knows? Fun fact, the real Casanova was a contemporary of the real Baron.
Oh.
They lived at the same time in Europe.
Wow. Interesting. So do you think the real-life Casanova was like, oh, I'm a real Munchausen?
Apparently in Germany, he's still called the Baron of Lies.
Oh, there you go.
In German, though. I don't know what that is, but I'm sure you do.
I don't. All right, Ishan, what's the build?
It is Swashbuckler Rogue 11, Valor Bard 6, Storm Sorcerer 3.
Okay, so Rogue is going to get us 4 expertises, which I'm confident will be include Persuasion and Deception.
Yeah, I also like Acrobatics because the Baron is a wonderful dancer. And I feel like that's probably the skill that is most closely emulates dancing.
Yeah, I like performance as well.
Oh, we should definitely. Yeah, that's your fourth one.
That's a storytelling.
Definitely, yeah. Performance. You get the rogue goodies, cunning action, uncanny dodge, evasion. And I think what really sort of makes the character is at level 11, reliable talent, which means all of those great skills that you have consistently are getting at least a 10 on the die.
Yep.
Like the Baron doesn't screw things up.
Right. He's very consistent in his tales. And then Swashbuckler gives you Panache, which allows you to make a persuasion check in order to charm a creature at will.
Mm-hmm. You can also, you know, if they're hostile, make them focus on you, but why would the Baron bother with that?
Why would he get in a fight?
Right. Valor Bard lets him make inspirational speeches and push his allies to better combat capabilities. We're also going to get 2 more expertises, you know, throw them on what you like. And, of course, extra attack. Because remember, the Baron, his background is a soldier. Most of his exploits came from, you know, fighting in wars.
Right. Yeah, I think he's a knight in order to become a Baron, right?
I think in those days, people just sort of like call themselves whatever.
No, I'm pretty sure that's not true. I'm pretty sure it's the exact opposite of that.
I think in Germany, you called yourself whatever because Germany wasn't a country.
No.
It was like many small duchies.
Yeah, but also, I don't believe you.
Like Duke Igthorn, I think, from the Gummy Bears is probably a German bear.
Okay. All right. Anyway, Valor Bard has extra attack, and reflavored spells will get you a lot of his tall tale kind of abilities and also help make those stories punch up a little bit.
Yeah, and even like literally real, maybe an illusion or so.
Yeah. Oh, I like the idea that he illustrates his stories with his illusions.
I do like that. I mean, in the movies, we basically see that happening. Maybe it's because he's casting an illusion of his story.
Yeah, that's called movie magic.
Yes, there we go. Movie magic.
Right.
Sorcerer. Storm Sorcerer allows you to be kind of light on your feet. A lot of the Baron's actual sort of amazing superhuman abilities are where he like appears to like weigh less than he normally does. I have a feeling that a lot of that ends up being like a quickened levitate or spider climb. Because the only 2 things that he really does where you're like, oh, well, that's impossible, are when he rides the cannonball.
Yeah.
Which I think is just a very good acrobatic check followed by a quickened spider climb.
Okay.
To stick to the cannonball.
All right.
And when he pulls himself up by his own ponytail, okay. Which is obviously just simply a levitate.
Right.
If you would like to play an entire party of Baron Munchausen, you can stat his companions pretty easily. Albrecht, who has so much superhuman strength that he can lift the entire Sultan's treasury in one sack.
Yeah, so that's Goliath or Firbolg Barbarian.
Yeah, maybe a fighter. Berthold is a very fast man. That's just our Flash build.
Oh, I should have put that in my party.
Oh, you totally should have.
Yeah.
No, also, the Flash is American. I got dibs.
There's Gustavus, the halfling, gnome, or dwarf, short guy, with Gust of Wind.
I like the idea that, you know, as he levels up, he learns more wind-based abilities, maybe like Wind Wall, eventually Whirlwind, things like that.
Yeah, that, I mean, that makes sense for a storm sorcerer, too.
Yeah.
A full storm sorcerer. Right.
And Adolphus is simply a sharpshooter. Excellent eyesight, can't miss.
All right, moving right along. If you want to support the show, the easiest way to do that is to leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, if you're willing to help us out, or read your 5-star review on the air.
You can also find us on Stitcher and Google Play. If you like or favorite us there, the algorithms will help other people find us.
All right, this next review comes with a warning. One, it involves us plying our musical talents, which are limited. And two, this is the likely last musical review we'll ever do. We will politely decline to read any others that are song lyrics. But this one comes from James Intricasso of the Don't Split the Podcast Network, the World Builder blog, and the Tabletop Babble podcast.
The Emmy-winning James Intricasso.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah, I've held his Emmy. He let me hold his Emmy.
Oh, well, congratulations.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was heavy.
Well, listeners, you can hate him for all of that and more just as soon as we get done with this review.
You can't hate him as much as we do, though.
No, that's definitely true. James, we're going to square up at Gen Con.
We know where you will be sleeping.
Yeah, true.
Are we recording now?
Yep.
Oh, am I supposed to talk over this?
Nope.
Does it matter?
It's not great.
Well, this is a story all about how my game got flipped, turned upside down, and I'd like to take a minute, just sit and chill, to tell you all about a podcast called Total Party Thrill.
In nerddom and geekdom, born and raised, round the table is where I spend most of my days. Mapping out, planning, DMing all cool and all, critting my PCs cause I'm not a fool. Venetian and Shane, they were up to some good. Started bringing ideas into my neighborhood. I got in one little cast and my brain got chills and said,
"You're scrapping to this podcast, go to the party thrill."
I listened each week and when it became clear, this cast is going to put my game in high gear. If anything, I could say their advice is rare, so I thought, don't forget it and tweet and share.
Players flock to my house to play all my games, and they yell to the others, "Yo, Holmes, we love James. Now my DMing is finally chill, thanks to the cast, Total Party Thrill." So let's never do that again.
Yeah.
Okay.
So what do we have planned for next week's episode?
We're talking about intercession communication.
That sounds incredibly dull, but I'm sure we'll punch it up a little bit.
Fascinating.
All right, what do we have planned for the Character Creation Forge?
Appropriately, we're building the Intercessor.
Now that sounds intriguing. But that's it for episode 100 of Total Party Thrill. I hope we've lived up to our name, but either way, I'm Shane.
And I'm Ishan. Thanks for listening.
All right, we're recording again.
Are we really?
Yeah. I'm recording. It's recording right now.
I miss the Athasian dragons. I feel like that was a missed opportunity. How do you make an Athasian dragon? You start with an S and then a more different S and then the consummate V's. And then you add like a big beefy arm.
My name is Boris.
And then you add a cool name like Boris. Boris the Burninator. Boris!
What are you talking? This is why we stopped drinking when we record.
Boris! Boris was a man. He was a dragon man. Maybe he was just a dragon. But he was still Boris!
Am I going to get a call from Kathleen when you get home? Like, yeah, what did you do to Ishan?
Why? It's all undone.
Yeah.
I just multiclassed from bard to barbarian. That's all that happened. Bard-barian.
The idea that you had bard before is highly questioned.
Right, that I was charisma primary.
Right. You definitely didn't have performance.
Or dexterity. Yeah. Or strength, let's be honest.
What's your con like?
You've been sick in a while. Con's pretty good. Yeah. Low strength,
high con.
Well, you've got that Asian constitution where you never get drunk, right?
No, I get drunk.
Well, that's a good point.
Look at me now, Mom.
Well, it's not an 18.
Fair. Fair. I'm not a mole. I ain't no mole.
Ugh, ain't no Steph.
High int. High whiz. Middling charisma. Come to Gen Con and judge for yourself. Because we'll be there, hanging out.
God, it's so hot in this room.
Hey, that, like, everybody.
I'm going to have to shower again before we go out.
That's what we should do. We should ask everyone, meet us at Gen Con, and then tell us what our stats are.
I feel like in a Gen Con crowd, I'm definitely going to get 18 strength.
Oh, fair, right? If you're great on a curve.
Like, yeah, but like... But if I were judged in by gym, I'd only be at like 16 or 14. I might be able to go for 20 at Gen Con.
Yeah, I'm human maximum.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Con max.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, because like 20 doesn't mean you're the strongest person. It means you're in the class of the strongest
people. Yeah, yeah. They don't break it down to like 18-1-0-0.
Yeah, I wouldn't be 18-0-0, that's for sure.
Because you're not a cheater.
Well, yeah. I mean, also, like, I'm not a professional athlete. Okay, I think we're done here.
Yeah.
Finally.
100!
I mean, not counting all the failed attempts at recording that, we're now at 147.
Oh, Jesus.
And that takes out the 12 minutes of attempting to record the Fresh Prince.
Right.
Which was not real time. That was 12 minutes of attempts.
We were not good at that.
No.
No. We do not have that as a skill proficiency.
Well, it was fun, though.
I agree.
All right.
Thanks, James. F*** you.
Yeah, die in a fire, James.